History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there, maybe even right next door, stories that should not go untold. What we've learned is they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and take the time to patiently listen to what some of our more experienced neighbors have to say. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. If you missed our last episode, you can access that podcast with pre-war seminarian turned P-51 Mustang ace Joe Peterburz at hometownheroesradio.com. We're going to hear the rest of Joe's story today, starting with the rest of what happened to him on April 10th, 1945. After shooting down a German ME-262 jet in his P-51, Joe was hit by ground fire while in the process of shooting down another enemy aircraft.
It blows up, and I'm pulling off, and I feel another thud, and I get oil over the windscreen, and so I'm pulling up. I get up to 10,000 feet and much altitude as I could. Then I try manipulated. There was some kind of a procedure. You manipulate the throttles, mix your prop control and that sort of stuff, and you get better performance or some performance on the engine. So I'm deciding whether or not to go to the east or the west. The Russians were closer, and they were to the east. And we were briefed that the front lines, the Allied front lines, were in the Magdeburg area. And Magdeburg's about 80 or 90 miles from where I am. So I decided to go to Magdeburg. I'm losing altitude all along, and I've been down to about 1,000 feet. I'm over Berg, which is a suburb of Magdeburg. It's just outside of Magdeburg. Anyway, I'm down to about 1,000 feet, and so I think, hell, I'm going to have to bail out. So I unstrap everything and get ready to, and I catch out of the side, my right side. I see this FW-190 coming in at me at my 3 o'clock position. My aircraft is burning by now. And so I pull into him. He fires his rockets. It misses. And by that time, I look, I'm down to 500 feet. I'm too low to bail out. I got to belly this thing in. So I'm looking, please. I can't believe it. I've unstrapped. I'll kill myself. So, of course, this is all milliseconds, of course, going on in your head and stuff. And it's training that is, you just do this stuff automatically. You know, new circumstances, other circumstances, things are popping through your mind, and you know what to do once you learn the circumstance. So anyway, I have to go out of the left side because the right side is burning. I mean, the fire is coming out of the right side of the engine. So I pull out, I get out in the wing and let myself go. And as published, I hit my knee on the horizontal stabilizer, pull the ripcord. My chute opens and I swing once and hit the ground hard. So at that time, I think, I better find out what's going on and where I am. I get up and I look around and, for nothing, not a tree for, 300-400 yards. And there's a group of 10 or 12 civilians coming at me. And so I'm looking at them. I think, I'm going to really get it. And about the same time, when they get to about 50 yards from me, a Luftwaffe sergeant comes tearing up on the motorcycle, stops and stops the civilians from taking me. He said, no, he pulls out his Luger and he's going to protect me, which is good because there were quite a few that were killed by civilians on that mission who were bailed out from that mission from the bombers. And anyway, about the same time, about four or five elderly gentlemen, probably in their 30s, 35, came out. And one was probably in his 50s or 60s. And he was the chief of police, wearing a leather hat. And he had a left arm. His left hand was a black leather glove, you know, probably lost his hand during World War One, but it was right out of one of Eric Stroheim's movies, you know. Mm-hmm. typical. That's what I was thinking at the time. And anyway, they take us into town. Sergeant says, okay, you can question him for a while. We go into probably the Burgermeister, the town hall or whatever they called it. And people are starting to gather outside. It's getting a little noisy. But anyway, we get in and they're searching my clothes and everything. They see, find a rosary that I always carried in my flight suit. They say, oh, I'm told later from the sergeant, they're saying, how could this Catholic be killing innocent men and women and children and stuff like that? You know, well. And chief of police, he pulls out his Luger and actually puts it to my head. He said he wanted to shoot me on the spot. And the sergeant pulled out his Luger and said, we're leaving. I'm going back to the base. So things quieted down. He took me out, put me on the motorcycle. By that time, the cows around was getting a bad crowd out there. So he takes me. He was stationed at a major airfield at the Berg. And that's where he goes. And then they put me in the local jail at the airfield, and I'm questioned by the Cassavo for, you know, no, nothing, just, you know, no torture or anything like that, but it's just questioning for about 2 days. Then they bring me down to the train station and put me on a boxcar, I was waiting for the train, them to put me on the boxcar, and one of the railroad guys, he comes up to me, he says, hey, you want a schnapps? I don't know what schnapps is. So I take a swig of that, and wow, you know.
Hello.
Those are, you know, just little things that it's hard to remember all the details around it, but I remember him giving me a schnapps. So I get on the train, and it's not a long, not even a, well, probably a couple hours. We get off, and I'm at Stalag 11, which is a POW camps, mainly occupied by British. But they had already evacuated the camp, and there was only about 100 Tommies left. And so we were put on a forced march. Put on a march. The next day, we started marching.
Lucky you.
off back to Berlin, where it all started, you know. And so we have 6 or 7 days of the march, and of course, it was just people, just refugees going from the east and the west, and just pandemonium. Motorcycles running up and down the road. The military vehicles were trying to get by and this sort of stuff, too. And they were just trying to get the traffic moving, and it's just hopeless. And then, to top it all off, a couple of times we were strafed by our own fighters, you know. And we survived that. I got to Stalag 3 at Luchtenwalde, which was a mostly Russian and some Scandinavian POWs. There were, I think, about 4 or 5 of us Americans. Tracy was there. He had ended up immediately after after the strafing was over. They sent him to Berlin, to Tempelhof, and then down to Luchtenwalde. So he was there. And two of the sergeants that were on B-17s that were shot down that we were escorting were there. And Lieutenant Stewart, who was strafing another airfield, was from our unit, was there. So I get there, and they already were planning escaping. One of the sergeants could speak fluent Russian, so they're, okay, we're going to get out of here and get in contact with the Russians. So I said, hey, I'll go along. And the escape was basically, you know, the security was practically non-existent. There were a few guards around. It was just a matter of going under the fence at night, which we did. And we went down about, probably walked about 5 miles along the road towards Berlin. And here comes a tank unit rolling down the road. The sergeant, we were hiding in the ditch, and the sergeant jumps out, says some Russian stuff to him, and waves us out, and we come out, and they throw me a gun and hop on the tank, and off we are to fight the Battle of Jitterbug and Wittenberg on the Elbe. So in Jitterbug, I'm out on the patrol with a sergeant, Russian sergeant. We come to a complex, civilian complex, housing complex, and really nice apartments and this sort of thing. So he's in there, and he is really mad. And he tells us to get outside, get out of the way. And he gets in the middle of the room with a burp gun. And He just stands with that room and destroys every, you know, they had nice radios, and nice furniture. And he just stood in the center of the room laughing like hell and just spraying everything. And I'll never forget that. I thought, this guy's a little nuts. You know?
It's the Russian rage at destroying German property, basically. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I want people to catch that because your story is pretty unique. There are not too many guys who can tell a story like this. So you're shot down. If that Luftwaffe officer doesn't come over, you're probably dead right there at the hands of civilians. Mm-hmm. He saves your life. You're a prisoner. You end up on a forced march. You survive that. The next POW camp, you escape, which the odds were overall in Europe in POW camps, not good for trying to escape, but you do that. And then, since you run into a Russian tank outfit, all of a sudden you're part of the Red Army.
Yeah.
You're fighting the same enemy, but for a different country.
Right.
You can't make this stuff up.
I know.
So now you're actually an infantryman in the Red Army.
Right. Uh-huh. And then from Jitterbug, we go all up to Wittenberg, and we have a few skirmishes on the way. Not major, but dead bodies, German bodies, laying, you know, soldiers all over the place as you're going by. That, you know, for a guy that's a fly, you know, we don't get close to the war. And I really increased my appreciation for what the ground troops do, because it was, you know, it's a horrible situation. You know, you just can't even compare. It's there's no comparison at all between the things you go through in the air and the things you go through on the ground. It is just, I mean, the leadership and the bravery and everything that's involved in fighting on the ground is so much surpasses what's in the air.
Well, and I guess the other question I have to ask you, because you told us the circumstances of your bailout, and even that, your odds of surviving a bailout from that low altitude the way you did are not strong. But I have to imagine that you weren't in the best of physical shape after that.
No, I had sprained my legs, and I had some burns on my leg and my arms. But it was, you know, 20 years old, how old you could take that.
All right. I feel for you. It's apparently you don't feel for yourself in that situation. No big deal. You were just tough enough to handle
that's
it.
That's right.
So now you're fighting with the Russian army, and this is getting close to Germany's surrender.
Yeah. Okay. And we're up about where we're at Elbe, at Elbon, and I mean, at Wittenberg, and our U.S. Army patrol comes across. And, oh, the group of us that escaped, I forgot to mention, someplace after we passed Jitterbug, I noticed I was, you know, we were separated throughout the thing, the column, and I lost contact with all the other Americans. I was the only one left.
And you don't speak Russian.
And I don't speak, you know, I could speak a little German, and we could do, and the Russian lieutenant could speak a little English and a little German too. So we were able to get some, but I couldn't get any really solid idea of what's on. When we get to Wittenberg and the patrol comes across, they're sort of hiding me. The Russians are sort of keeping me out of sight. They're not, you know, hey, here's your buddies coming in. They were keeping me out of sight. And fortunately, the team leader, the patrol leader, saw this flight suit. He knew it was an American flight suit, so he started talking to the lieutenant. You know, who's that back there? And they had some discussion back and forth, and reluctantly, he released me to the patrol. But anyway, well after the war, over 60 years after the war, I find out from Sergeant Lewis, who we came in contact with each other. He was one of the escapees, the sergeants. We came in contact through a mutual German researcher. Oh, back in, it was, I think, about 1998 or 9 or something like that. And he told me, he said, that a American general came over and met the Russians, and they took all of those guys back with him. And I'm thinking, well, what the hell? You know, why was I left behind? Didn't they tell him that there was another guy in it? Or was there some kind of a, you know, I have no idea. And I'm the only guy left now. So it's impossible. But it's a fog of war that I'll never understand.
So according to that version, all the Americans had been reclaimed from the Soviet unit.
Yeah.
And it sounded like you were saying the Soviet commander was reluctant to let you go.
Yeah.
What do you think would have happened to you if You had to stay with those
guys. I think I was just a pawn for, you know, at this time all the political stuff was going, Potsdam conferences, you know, all this was going on. Patton wanted to continue the war to go Russia. So there was, and I think maybe they just, I have no idea, absolutely no idea. And I didn't really give a crap back then when I was really just having a lot of fun. No, I was taking care of myself.
Which really was no small undertaking, given everything we've heard from Joe Peter Burrs and what he went through. There are some things we haven't heard, like what led to this former seminarian's wedding almost immediately upon his return to the States. What did Joe do during the Korean War? And before that, his role in the integration of the Air Force after President Harry Truman put an end to segregation in our military. Don't forget to check out Joe's website, joepeterburrs.com. I have it linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, and we'll be right back after this. If you're a business owner, I've got a phone number you really ought to take down, 800-989-1139. And when I say business owner, I mean businesses of all shapes and sizes, from the multinational chain to the hot dog stand on the corner, or my personal preference, the taco truck, 800-989-1139. Because you can have the greatest product or service in the world, the best business plan, the most capable workforce, and still not maximize your potential if you don't have a reliable, efficient, and versatile plan for processing payments. 800-989-1139. That's the number for my friends at Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in the country. Why is Provident growing so fast? Because they're committed to helping your business grow. 800-989-1139. That nonprofit you love that relies on donations? Provident can even connect you to a special software platform to streamline and stimulate giving. If you are ready to grow, give it a go. Go Provident today at ProvidentPayments.com or call that number, 800-989-1139.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and the rest of our conversation with 96-year-old Joe Peter Burrs of Roseville, California. When we left off, the ace fighter pilot turned ex-prisoner of war had just been reunited with American forces after some time spent fighting with a Soviet unit.
So I go with the patrol back to Holly, which was a big Air Force unit, but the that patrol's unit, was its headquarters was there. So we go out at a couple of patrols. I go out on a couple of patrols with them and picking up souvenirs. And we'd roust all the people out in the town and tell them to bring all their weapons to the town square and pile them up and stuff like that. Picked up a few and played a lot of poker with the army guys that got me drunk and won all my good souvenirs and that sort of stuff. But anyway, it was, you know, a lot of fun. And then, but I got tired of it. I was there for, I think, 2 days. And so I said, I'm going to take off. So I just took off and started walking down the road and walked probably 5, 6, 7 miles. And there's a C-47 parked in an open field. And there's about 10 or 12 people in striped suits, emaciated, standing around the C-47. And then there are two lieutenants flying it, pilot, co-pilot. And I go over and I say, hey, where are you going? He says, Paris. He says, what's this? All this is? He says, well, they're liberated political prisoners. And we're taking them back to Paris. And I said, well, I could come along. He says, yeah. And I thought, what better than that? You know, go to Paris. A big mistake. Anyway, we hop in the, oh, and then an afterthought, not, oh, I don't think it's just been the last couple of years, I thought, how the hell could I, the patrol, recoup me from the Russians, go back to their base, and I'm not talked to by anybody, not an officer, I'm just with that patrol. Did the patrol not tell somebody that I was with them? I thought it's great to have this fly boy going out on patrol with him. What the heck? I have no idea. But in my old age, I think about these things. Well, what the hell kind of a business was that? Yeah. Well, what kind of a business was it for me being able to wander all the way around Europe anyway, the way it was?
Very improbable. Yeah. But so then you end up on this C-47 with folks who just have been liberated from a concentration camp.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And end up in Paris, and there I'm deloused, tagged, and officially a reclaimed POW. And I am under control of my life of wandering over Europe.
Maybe for your own good.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you said something earlier, very early on. You said that the day you got shot down, your thought was with your mother.
Yeah.
Who's already lost one of her sons in this war. And what is she going to know? What is she going to hear? I'm sure you were able to piece that together later about what information she had after you were shot down.
Yeah, well, immediately telegrams going out to say that I was liberated and stuff, because I was still missing in action. You know, I wasn't notified as a POW. None of that stuff would have processed itself back into the system. So as far as everybody knew, I was still missing in action.
So she didn't know you were alive until when?
Well, until she got the message saying that I've been repatriated.
And then did you go home and see her?
Well, yeah, I went home to get married.
Well, that's a big piece of the story, too.
Yeah, my fiance, Josephine, I named my aircraft after her. Anyway, I go back on the last convoy and get to Fort Sheridan by... I arrived in the States on the 1st of June, and then on Fort Sheridan about the 5th of June, I think it was, and then back into Milwaukee, and then immediate arrangements. And of course, my mother's elated, and my two brothers, my brother Bill, who was stationed at Fort Monmouth, and my brother George was home too. So she had her three sons back from the war, and they're planning my wedding. So... We got married on the 13th of June of 1945, and had a 60-day leave, and then added another 30 days onto that. So we had 90 days, 30 days up in Wisconsin Dells on our honeymoon. Mm. But anyway, when I got married, I had to get my mom's permission to get married because I hadn't turned 21 yet. But Josephine was 20, and women were liberated, I guess, when they were 18 or whatever.
Well, I think we have to put some other dots together here, too, because if folks remember, before Pearl Harbor, you were in seminary. Mm-hmm. You had made the decision you're going to be a Catholic priest, mm-hmm. which comes with a vow of celibacy.
Oh,
you're never
yeah.
going to be married.
Oh, yeah.
So somewhere along the path from going into the Army Air Corps to coming home as a liberated prisoner of war...
Okay, you want
that story changed. I mean, that's a big part. That's a big change from going to be a priest to, hey, I'm getting married as soon as I get back to the States.
Okay, when I was in the seminary, during summer vacation, I got a job at St. Joseph's Hospital, where I was a handy boy, cutting grass and cleaning up stuff in the hospital and this sort of thing. And there was a beautiful little girl of blue eyes and 5 foot tall and... that I saw, and we became very good friends, platonic, mm-hmm. truly and really, a really truly platonic relationship, and that was for the two summers before the war started. Then, when the war started, and I was going in, I knew that I had to concentrate on what I was going to be doing. Number one, I couldn't have relationship type of thing. Going on, and besides that, I had, it was platonic at the time, and we didn't even think about talking about marriage or anything like that. So I go off and finish my training, and then when I graduate, second lieutenant, I have a leave before I go on to further training to Milwaukee, and I go back to show off myself at the hospital to all the bunch of old Germans that work there, and they. When I say old, I'm talking about 35 or 40 years old, to me at the time, or old. And anyway, I'm walking by the cafeteria, and I see a group of four girls sitting there eating, and one of them was Josephine. And I think maybe by that time, my dedication to becoming a priest had sort of waned a little bit. And so I walked over, and I said, "Hi, Joe." And here's I'm in my, pinks and greens and silver wings and handsome guy.
Yeah, I've seen pictures,
and all the girls are swooning, and So anyway, they all are breathtakingly waiting till Joe gives her that answer. And she looks up and says, well, anytime. Yeah. When do you want to go out? Tonight.
What did you think?
Yeah. And then we started our relationship. So then we wrote daily when I went back to training and stuff. And then before I went overseas, I had another leave. And I proposed to her. We were in the living room and by herself, and she was sitting on the couch, and I got down on my knees, and I had the big old diamond engagement ring. Not really big, a little tiny one.
It's all relative.
Yeah. And I proposed to her, and she looked down, and she had a tear in her eye, and she said yes. And so that was the beginning of a 60-year love affair.
And it underscores what you said earlier, that you really never thought there was a chance you wouldn't come back. Because mm-hmm. I'm sure you wouldn't have done that if you didn't think you were coming back.
Yeah, yeah.
That was something pretty important to get back for.
Right, absolutely, absolutely.
Wow, that's neat. I'm glad you included that. And then the other thing that hits me, Joe, is all this stuff you went through in World War II. I mean, you lost a brother. You almost lost your own life. You saw friends of yours get killed. You have to endure life as a prisoner, even getting caught up in another country's army at the end of the war. All these things you went through. For some people, I think that would have been enough.
Mm-hmm.
They would have been ready to jump out of the Army Air Corps after the war.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you stay in? And you didn't stay in for just a few years, 36 years.
Yeah. Well, no, my dad had been in, you know.
Yeah.
And I had made up my mind sometime along this way, period I was in, that I was going to make it a career. I had two things after the war. I was either going to be a dentist or I was going to stay in. Because I had some kind of a thing, because I was going to the dentist. You know, I called myself, I have depression teeth. During the depression, you go, you had a toothache, it pulled. You know? So you don't have many teeth left after a while. But anyway, I talked it over with Jill, and she was amenable. We knew what the thing was, moving, and hard, bring up a family and all that sort of stuff with it. But we both agreed that that'd be it, so that we made a joint decision that I'd go ahead and stay in. It was really, the first, right after the war, golly, it was, got back after things settled down, and I finally got my assignment. My first assignment after my leaves was back to Dothan, Alabama, to Napier. And so we get on the train, and by the way, I was doing all this flight and everything before I ever got a car license. To drive a car.
Couldn't drive a car, but you could fly a
T-51. When I came home from the war, I learned how to drive a car. Anyway, it was Dothan. We get there. It's open a week, and they close the field. So up to Truex Field, Wisconsin. We're there for a month, and they close the field. And then we go down to Chanute in Illinois, and there we stay for 3 years. And while there, I'm commander of, this is 1945 to 1948, and I'm commander of a all-black unit, 400-plus men, and I'm not 20 years old yet, haven't turned 21 yet, and still...
And that's right when President Truman is integrating the armed forces.
That's where I'm coming to.
Yeah.
I'm commander, and he desegregates. So it's my responsibility to be able to smoothly and efficiently and without any problems integrate my units, my men, into the white units.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the difference is, see, the all-black units, they were segregated. They were all different MOSs, specialties. And then the white units, the specialties was the squadron, you know, all the engineers and that sort of stuff. All the military police were together and this sort of thing. So it was, I had to determine, you know, which units they would be going to and to integrate them. And it took a good year before I got the last. I had a system of spies and this sort of thing that would let me know if there's any, you know, there was
if there were incidents.
Yeah, incidents and this sort of stuff. And I got a pretty good job. So in June of 47, I was promoted to captain at 22, I think I was going on, or was 22.
Well, and again, there's another story that really only you can tell on that. And I've talked to a lot of the African-American pilots, you know, who flew in World War II in these segregated units. And, you know, they had a lot of different stories of how they were treated, of what they were trying to prove.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a feel for what some of them had been through? And were there some challenges that you faced in assigning them to these now integrated units for the first time?
Well, I had a pretty good idea because all my training was in the Southeast. And, you know, and I got in trouble a couple of times, or almost officially in trouble, because of my lack of adherence to their Jim Crow laws and all that sort of stuff. The bubbler, the, you know, the movies, and they'd have the balcony, they'd have segregated, you'd go into the department, all the store, you know, whites only, and, you know, drinking fountains, toilets, everything. And I, coming from Wisconsin, I say my only association, we had one African-American seminarian in my class, and I got to know him pretty well, and, you know, we got along swell. And so I had an idea, but I also knew that I was 21 years old, and when I took over command of this unit, and that the first sergeant was a 20-year veteran, and I knew who could run their outfit. And he was my right arm and left arm in running the outfit. So I didn't do anything without his counsel and so on. So we ran the outfit together.
And he was white or black?
Oh, black. Oh, I was the only white person.
You're the only white guy?
Only white person.
With 400 black pilots?
Yeah, not pilots.
Of all?
Well, cooks, bakers, employees, whatever the jobs were, mechanics. So
that sounds like something you're proud of.
Oh, I am. Yeah, I really, you know, still see he is always sort of standing over my shoulder, and he'd keep me on the straight and narrow.
It's break time again, but there's more to come with 96-year-old retired Air Force Colonel Joe Peterburz. How many missions did he fly during the Korean War? And how was it that he came to meet the German ace he had shot down moments before Joe was shot down in 1945? Hear those details as only he can share them when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, coming down the home stretch with Joe Peterburz. I think by now you're understanding why his remarkable story wouldn't quite fit into 1 hour. If you missed the first part of his story last week, you can listen to that podcast at hometownheroesradio.com, where I also have links to the books he's written. Those are available through his website, joepeterburz.com. As you know, Joe became a fighter ace during World War II, but let's hear now what he was up to during the Korean War.
Okay, in 1950, I got assigned to the 18th Fighter Bomber Group, flying out of South Korea. I hadn't flown a P-51 since the day I was shot down. I'd flown C-47s and B-25s and AT-6s, but very limited. They were, because I was an administrative, all I did fly them for is proficiency.
Sure.
And for the flying pay, you know, you had to get 4 hours a month and three landings in order to collect your flying pay. But it was, you know, it was a lot of flying. So anyway, I get to Korea. I'm assigned, and I get called into the Wing Commander General Rogers' office, and they said, we're going to make you the finance officer, because I had, after the black assignment, I was assigned to finance, accounting and dispersing. And I was, when I was sent to Korea, I was an accounting and dispersing officer. A finance officer, took care of all the pay and this sort of stuff. I got a lot of side stories on that. But anyway, and he said, we're going to put you as a finance officer here. And I said, well, why? He said, well, you've had two brothers killed. He said, we're not. And I said, well, I think you're misinterpreting, General. You're misinterpreting the regulation. The regulation applies to the only surviving son. And I'm not the only surviving son. So I've got three brothers at home yet. And I said, I don't want to be the finance officer. And then after several consultations and stuff like that, he said, okay, you can fly. So I went out and checked out the 51, just hopped in, got flown 5 hours, and then started flying combat. It was a completely different thing. You know, the P-51 was the worst aircraft in an inventory for the job. We had to do close air support, interdiction, that sort of stuff. You know, you just P-47, P-38 was great for it, but not the P-51. But anyway, we had a lot of losses. And so I went through that, had quite a few battle damages, and then one, I got shrapnel in the face, and it was a napalm. A target was troops in trenches along a mountain ridge. And Korea, there's mountains all over the place. I mean, you had to worry about, if you went down into the valleys to get the thing, you had to be able to get out over those mountains. And anyway, this was a line of troops, and I had a flight of four with napalm and 5-inch rockets. So we went in, had a real good napalm run, and came around, and I fired the popping off. Now, no remote control or any of that sort of stuff. Your rockets went where your aircraft was pointing.
Right.
And if you were in a slip, the rockets, if you were in a skid or anything, you know. My technique was I would fire my 50s, and if I'd see where, and if my 50s were hitting the target, then that's where the rockets would hit. Because then, you know, if there was a slip, I could see the tracers. I mean, the explosives on the ground, you could tell that.
Sure.
So anyway, I popped off two rockets. I was straight and level and ready to pop off the third one. And pow! A bullet comes up in the wing, smashes the canopy, throwing plexiglass all around, and then right alongside my head, my helmet, and bounces off the armor plate. So I reach up, my hands full of blood. I called back to base. I wobbled my wings. My wingman lost communication, so he didn't have any communications. I couldn't talk to him. So I wobbled, signaled, and he joined up, and I went back to base. And they had all the stuff ready, the meat wagons and everything, and we get over the base. And before I could peel off, my wingman, he pulls off and lands. And I'm coming around, and I see all the meat wagons chasing him down the road.
They think he's you?
Yeah. So I land and nonchalantly taxi over to my parking revetment, and I'm down getting my maps and straightening up my comp. And my crew chief hops up on the wing, and he's waiting for a report. And I get up, and he sees me, and he slips off the wing. He almost breaks his leg.
He was so shocked at the appearance of
your
face.
Yeah.
Wow.
So anyway, It was a matter of plexiglass. I had a little strain in my shoulder, and then the plexiglass, and about 3 or 4 hours of the flight surgeon picking out plexiglass, and I flew, I think, 3 days later. Flew another mission. So anyway, I flew 76 missions. I was the a flight leader, assistant group operations officer, group training officer, and test pilot, all that sort of stuff while I was with the 18th.
And you say it all like none of it's a big deal. And I don't think any of us have ever spent 4 hours with a flight surgeon picking plexiglass out of our faces. And that had to be painful, right?
I can't remember. I don't think so. I'm sure it was painful a little.
And you could see fine? Didn't damage your eyes?
Oh, no,
or anything?
It didn't damage my eyes. I had the visor down on my eyes. So.
Well, the other question that came to mind as you were describing that is, of course, you told us the story of you and Joe and how you met and how you married. So now in Korea, when they're giving you an out, they're saying, no, we don't want you to fly combat. You've had two brothers killed, one in World War II, one in Korea, and you're fighting for the chance to fly. How did your wife feel about that?
She didn't know. And no knowledge at all of it.
So when you get shot up and your face is bleeding, you thinking you're going to have some explaining to do here?
Oh, yeah, probably, but I wasn't worried about it. She would be so happy to see me.
I guess so.
Scars or not.
I guess so. Well, there's so much. I really appreciate all your time. There is one more thing I know I have to ask you about, and if there's anything else you want to stick in there, feel free. I don't want to forget to say thank you, sir. Thank you for serving our country and for telling us a story that I think is blowing people's minds in a lot of ways. Mm. They've never heard a story like this before, but you've lived it. And there's another part of that story you mentioned, you alluded to it earlier, that when you shot down that ME-262 right before you got shot down, that later on you learned what he did, that pilot did, because you actually got to meet the German mm-hmm. pilot in that jet that you shot down in April of 1945. Mm-hmm. How did that come about, and what was the significance of that meeting and reunion for you?
Well, the first thing is I had never claimed that I shot him down, see. I never claimed it, because all I knew is he had a little smoke and fire coming out of his wing, and I didn't know he had to bail out or anything. So I never put in a claim that mm-hmm. I shot him down. So back in the mid-90s, there are a lot of researchers, German researchers and so on, that they were trying to... And it all initially happened when I got a letter from Germany from a guy that was a 13-year-old kid from Berg that was observing in the ditch, observing the air battles going on. And he saw this P-51 being attacked by the FW-190 and bailing out and being captured and being questioned and the crowd hanging around. He saw all that. And Berg is in East Germany. And so he becomes the amateur historian. And when Germany is reunited, the TV stations are starting to catch up and start doing things that World War II that were not allowed to do under East Germany. And they were doing a series, the local TV was doing a series on recovery of World War II aircraft. So he talks to the TV station and doing a series. He says, I know where this 51 is. And he tells them all the story and stuff. So they go ahead and they come out with their big backhoes and big, huge, I've got pictures of metal detectors. And they find the aircraft. They've excavated it and this sort of stuff. So this guy, Werner Dietrich, his name is, he spends the next 18 months trying to find a pilot of that aircraft. He goes through all sorts of researching, and I won't go into the details of that, but eventually he gets my name as a possibility, and he writes me a letter, and he explains all this, and he says, could that be you? And I said, well, everything sounds perfect. It sounds like it's me. And then the TV station wants to do a follow-on, so they want me to come to Germany. Well, my wife at this time had a stroke, and I wasn't about to leave her. Mm-hmm. So the whole crew and Werner come over to Colorado Springs. So, of course, all Werner knows is he saw this guy bail out, and he thinks I'm shot down from the air battle above Magdeburg. So when I tell him the story, he says, I'm going to find that 262 pilot. So I think, good luck. And so anyway, he comes back, and after about 2-3 months, I get a letter. Of course, he's snail mail at the time. He didn't have a computer, so it was 10 days for mail there and 10 days back. So anyway, about 2 months, after his meeting in Colorado Springs. He comes back with a letter. Eureka, I've found him. It was Walter Schuch, a German ace with 198 kills in the ME-109 and 8 kills in the 262 for 206 victories. I said, I'll take 50%, you know, the fog of war and all this sort of stuff. I wasn't positive. And then I'm too occupied with taking care of my wife. I couldn't be fiddling around with this stuff. So anyway, about 2002, I think it was, the guy that's writing Walter Schuch's biography, Christer Bergström, he's a prolific Swedish writer and researcher, and he has been trying to find the guy who shot down Walter ever since the war. So anyway, I get an email from him, and he says, hey, I understand that you wrote a narrative on your last mission. And he said, would you mind sending it to me? I said, okay. So I sent it to him, and of course, he's got a computer, so instantaneous. And so he gets my story, and after about 2 days, he comes back. He says, 100% positive, you're the one that shot him down. I said, how could you be 100%. He says, your timelines, how you describe it and how Walter describes it, neither one of you knowing each other or knowing anything about it. He says, everything fits in perfectly. I said, yeah, okay. I'll give it maybe 90%, but that's about it. And then he says, comes back, he says, no, he said, because Walter is the only 262 that shot down two B-17s on that mission over Oranienburg. In fact, he shot down four. He had shot down two before he hit your box. He says he shot two in this one box. He explains that, and then he came over into your box, and that's when you latched on to him. He says, I'm 100% sure. So I'll say, okay, I'll accept that. Mm-hmm. And then in 2005, I get a message from both Christer Bergström and from Kurt Schultz, who was a buddy of Walter Schuch's in the Izmir when they were flying up with the 109s off of Russia, off of Murmansk. They both say that Walter's going to be in the States in May of 2005 at Vista, California, and we'd like you to be there to meet him and this sort of stuff. I said, well, I just lost my wife, and I said, no, I'm not about to. So they keep pressing me, and then Sabrina and Rick, they say, you got to come and get your mind off of it. So anyway, I agreed, and unbeknownst to me, there was another thing they wanted the meeting for, because unbeknownst to me, some famous artist in Canada had done a painting of me shooting down Walter Schuch, and it was going to be hot stuff on the market, and they wanted us both to be there to sign it. So anyway, we go down, and I come here to visit my grandson and great-granddaughter, and this sort of stuff, and of course they're little babies then. We go down to Vista, and I meet him for the first time, and we became instant friends. He was a real gentleman. You know, most of us, the war was fought up in the Izmir, and those guys were separated from the whole part of Germany. You know, they were playing American jazz. All of these things would be death sentences. They were playing American jazz. His favorite singer was Vera Lynn from Britain. They were just a complete isolated outfit. And he was in all his, you know, he was number one. He's called the Eagle of the North because of his eyesight. That's how he got most of his skills. He'd be able to see aircraft before anybody else. Anyway, he was a real gentleman. We spent a lot of time together until his departure in 15, I think it was.
So eventually you became convinced that the 20-year-old kid really did shoot down one of the greatest German aces of all time?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I know it, and Walter knows it.
Yeah.
And Walter, always, every time we were at any place, he'd say, and here's the guy that saved my life, Joe Peterburs. Because if had I not shot him down, and he had not been able to bail out, and the circumstances of this thing, he would have been dead, because he would have been flying the next day, and those guys were being destroyed all the time. And the possibility of him surviving the war would have been practically nil.
And I didn't ask before, had you ever encountered jets before that mission?
Not encountered them, you know, as far as attacking and stuff like that. But yes, we encountered them. I think on four or five of my missions, we had seen the jets, but they were mostly hit and run. And we were given strict orders not to chase them unless you had altitude advantage or they were taking off or landing. Those are the only. And all, if you research the kills, they will all be that. They'll either have a altitude advantage. I know of no dogfight between a 51 or any piston aircraft than a 262.
Because the odds would not be in your favor.
No.
I mean, it's pretty incredible that this is what happened, right? I'm not overstating that, am I?
No, it's the whole thing is a bunch of believe it or not. You know?
It is. So how do you make sense of all of that? How do you explain it?
I have no idea. I'm just a kid from Milwaukee trying to do his job for God and country.
I guess I need to know, too, what did that mean to you, that friendship that you ended up forging with Walter Shook? What was the significance of that in your life?
I have generally been a judgmental person of my whole, It told me how unrealistic that is to be judgmental, because you have to really become to know people before you start throwing things around and really judging a person's character or a person, what he's all about. And it's too easy to put labels on people and not take them. I mean, at first, understand what you're talking about. Understand what the person is about. Know somebody before you start passing judgment on them, Because, a good example, why did they want to kill me? Why did the civilians want to kill me? Why did that police chief take out his Luger and put it to my head and want to blow my brains out? You know why? The sergeant tells me, he said, 3 days before, a flight of B-17s came by and strafed the village, and one of the little three-year-old girl had her head blown off. Now, put yourself in the same situation. Your daughter's out there. It's pretty hard to grasp that.
Takes you back to war as hell, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I can't thank you enough, sir. It's a real incredible story you have. You tell it so well, and I really appreciate your patience with me and your willingness to share.
Okay.
My last question is, I have two. One is there something you'd say you're most proud of in your life?
Well, I was proud of my, as far as my military is concerned, my last assignment in which I commanded thousands of troops in very extremely difficult situations in Europe during the Cold War. I ended 7 years in this job, and all the my troops called me Colonel Pete. And one of the most rewarding things is that I moved here and was able to be an active participant in bringing up my two great granddaughters. At 80 years old, I had to learn how to change diapers and take care of and play games of princes and knights and all that sort of stuff. And it's just been a wonderful experience.
Well, and they wouldn't be here if you didn't survive being a POW.
Yeah.
Or I guess if you had stayed in seminary.
Yeah.
Last question. Is there something, I know you've had an incredible life here for 96 years, is there something that you have not done yet that you're still hoping to do, that you're looking forward to doing?
Well, actually, I'd like to do one more parachute jump so I could get my paratrooper wings. See, I bailed out another time. I didn't bail out. I ejected explosive ejection from a T-33 in 1954.
Ooh.
Back then, it was all manual. You sat in the seat. I had a fire in the plenum chamber, and I was at altitude in the weather. And anyway, I got a fire in the plenum chamber light. You got to pull up your things. You got the trigger, you got to blow the canopy, and then you pull the trigger and a 37 millimeter cannon shell blows you out of the cockpit, and of course you're tumbling. So you have to release yourself from the seat, and you're still tumbling, and the seat's tumbling behind you, and so you have to figure out when you want to pull your chute to make sure that it doesn't get tangled.
Talk about Russian roulette.
So, yeah. And anyway, then you bail out. Anyway, that was it in Florida. I landed in Everglades, and I got a big black eye, I guess. So I didn't hook my oxygen cord, and then came flying up, hit me in the face.
So you're saying if you could trade your caterpillar club for paratrooper wings.
Yeah. Yeah.
With one more jump, you'd be willing to
jump,
do it.
Yeah. I think, I don't know what it is now, but anyway, you had to have three jumps. And my brother always runs that. My kid brother, really, he's passed away now. So he always kidded me about the paratroopers that I didn't have those.
I'm pretty sure there are plenty of skydiving facilities that would love to give Joe that chance, especially after all that this 36-year veteran of our armed forces has given to our country. Joe Peterburz, 96 years old. Check out his website at joepeterburz.com. hometownheroes.com, linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com as well. And I hope you can join us again next time when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.